You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. This is a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Universal Spirituality and Human Physicality, Bridging the Divide. And it is Collected Works, Volume 202, translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 7, delivered in Dornach on the 11th of December 1920. We will speak today of aspects of human morality, going on tomorrow to show that this moral domain of the human soul leads us into the macrocosm. Ultimately, we are concerned here with the proper evaluation of two human characteristics, if we are to arrive at a thorough understanding of the nature of our moral being and psyche. We stand, if you like, in the middle of two extremes, two polar opposites, which we grow aware of as the natural order on the one hand and the moral order on the other. We have spoken of how the worldview developing over recent centuries and becoming ever more widespread and popular is incapable of building a bridge between these two domains. If we are to get any nearer to solving the riddles of life and the world, we need to consider, above all, two human qualities which relate to these polar contrasts of nature. And let's say, of the spirit, or also the moral world order. We are indubitably given up to the natural world. In a sense, our psyche and moral being are dependent on it. But to feel ourselves truly human, we also need to raise ourselves out of the merely natural order of things and feel ourselves to exist within a world order that is not subsumed in nature. Only by pursuing the path of spiritual science, in fact, will we come to a clear view of what is involved here. To start with, let us examine a pervasive and erroneous idea which prevents people from solving the riddles that lie hidden there. There is a long-standing tradition that we can understand our own human nature by looking in some immediate way for the connection between aspects of soul-spirit and the physical body. People picture the human body here, say, and then the soul and spirit within it somehow, and then they look for the connection between them, Plate 8. Such a connection has been much sought, and a great portion of humanity's endeavors in philosophy have focused on discovering the nature of this connection between soul and spirit, or mind, on the one hand, and the body on the other. As you will know by now, the science of the spirit tackles most of these issues, to which so much popular attention is devoted, in a quite different way. The questions themselves must be formulated differently in spiritual science from the trivial form in which they frequently appear. Especially in the 19th century, popular views, also theoretical ones, that no such thing as soul and spirit can be discovered alongside the physical body, have become widespread and even fixed. In this view, the soul and spirit are seen only as a kind of product of the body. People familiar with the great findings of scientific research find such a view extremely alluring. It allows them to see the human being as dependent on nothing but physical processes between birth and death, on his whole physical organism. Materialistic thinkers have repeatedly pointed out that our mental faculties develop in conformity with the development of the body, from the very first days of childhood onward, and that when our body is not properly cared for, our soul spiritual development suffers too. Likewise, when we enter old age and the body deteriorates, it can be shown that our mental faculties decline. Certain injuries can also lead to abnormalities in mind and soul, and thus we are dependent on the way our corporeal nature is constituted. A person can ingest poisons which induce a merely chemical effect in him, and yet in consequence, he can also display certain types of mental abnormality. And similarly, symptoms of paralysis are triggered by physical substances to which the body succumbs. In other words, tangible results are available in empirical physical research to demonstrate that basically the mind and psyche are merely a function of the body. Researchers who pursued this line of inquiry and developed a corresponding outlook have also been able to point to microphenomena of this type. For instance, the fact that thyroid abnormalities affect psychological and emotional capacities has led scientists such as Gley, G-L-E-Y, to conclude that our highest human faculties are ultimately dependent on the chemical processes at work in the thyroid. All these things have something of an allure in the whole way that scientific thinking has developed in modern times. As increasing numbers of people came to embrace this scientific mode of thinking, ideas about the soul and spirit were suppressed. Increasingly, the mind and psyche came to be seen as something of no autonomous significance. These developments gave rise to a very marked contrast in the civilized world. On the one hand are those who develop more or less of an allegiance to modern scientific thinking, regarding their rejection of an autonomous mind and soul as a sign of their great cultural progress, if that's what we can call it. And on the other is the remainder of the population, those who want to go on adhering to old religious beliefs, to old ideas about the human spirit and soul, about a moral world order, but in fact can only cling to these old traditions by distancing themselves from views propounded by modern scientific thinking. On the one hand, therefore, we have a numerous populace whom others see as stuck in the past, as people who know nothing about natural laws and therefore remain stuck in their old religious beliefs. And yet in recent times, increasingly, something else has arisen. The fascination and compelling allure of scientific ideas, so ubiquitous in the mid-19th century, or also still at the beginning of its latter third, has gradually waned, even amongst many scientific thinkers. People have grown more tolerant toward views that they previously thought must inevitably disappear and were just a throwback. Yet this latter phenomenon has to be attributed, really, to the somnolence of modern souls. For basically, it is impossible to have an all-pervasive natural order at the same time as a real ethical and spiritual world order. The way the natural order is regarded today is irreconcilable with a moral world order, and it is only possible to let it coexist with old traditions of various religious beliefs by failing to think properly. The only people who have really been consistent are those who insisted around the middle of the 19th century in the 1850s and 60s that the view of the human being as a physical being alone, whose mental and psychological qualities arise from corporeal processes, was one which should gradually supersede all other views and eradicate them. In public lectures in Basel and elsewhere, I also pointed out that there were individuals who rigorously propounded the view that a moral world order must be dismantled, and that basically a criminal has just as much right to do what he does as someone who harbors moral ideals. These people were at least consistent, but such consistency was not courageously maintained. Gradually, a casualness or somnolence developed, giving rise to what I just described. On the other hand, though, there is consistency in the opposite views of those, mainly of a Jesuit persuasion in the Catholic Church, who say, quote, away with all science, close quote, and seek to inquire instead into something other than external facts. Such people wish to drum into others a belief in a soul-spiritual world order, and root it in them by all kinds of outer compulsion. Neither view or approach is in the least sustainable as humanity evolves further. Yet nothing is sustainable either that originates in the unclear or confused thinking of past traditions. Above all, as long as we consider only our present existence, the idea of the human being as a corporeal entity containing a soul is not sustainable. Nor will we discover how the one and the other are connected. To understand the human being, we must first expand our mode of observation to encompass a much broader span of time, invoking the help of time. The schema of the soul sitting in the body is quite impossible, and only the following picture can give rise to clear concepts, which, as we will see, lead us further and enable us to build a bridge between moral and physical views of the world. Before we descend to physical existence on earth, we live, as you know, in a world of spirit between death and a new birth. If we regard this line as indicating time, and there's a plate 8 and there's an arrow, we have a life of spirit and soul between death and a new birth which runs in the stream of time. Now, in connection with facts which I tried to describe to you yesterday, what one can call desire for physical corporeality gradually forms within our being of spirit and soul through processes in the world of spirit while we develop without a physical body. This process of development gradually gives rise to a desire for physical corporeality. A proper grasp of the idea of metamorphosis will show us things in the following light. This desire actually flows over into physical corporeality so that when we look at a child, we see fulfillment manifest in him of the desire for physical corporeality, which his soul and spirit possessed before he entered physical existence. We ought not to see here a duality whereby physical nature is distinct from soul and spirit. The body is not something the spirit and soul slip into, but rather something into which they are transformed. For our modern scientific community, this poses significant problems, since it clings to whatever is most apparent and salient. Observing how the embryo develops in the womb, scientists believe that it simply grows from the mother's body after fertilization, and that her body contains forces which make the embryo grow. In fact, this is not so. An explanation of this kind includes only what is most immediately apparent. We are beings who stand in the world in connection with the whole cosmos. What would we say if someone were to assert that the volume of air your body contains at any particular moment has simply emerged from within you? It has not. You have breathed it in, and the air inside you exists there by virtue of your unity with the whole surrounding world. People only think that the human embryo develops in the womb from forces contained in the mother's body because they do not perceive the influx from without. Do not see that here above all there is an intimate connection with the whole macrocosm. The human germ clearly originates in the world of spirit, merely losing the locus where, in a sense, it finds a doorway to enter the physical world. There is nothing in the realms of space spread around us that can offer such a door for the soul to enter the physical world after passing through the period between death and a new birth. The only way in is through the human body itself. Not the physical forces of father and mother alone, but cosmic powers are at work here, dynamically involved. And having developed a sense for corporeality as a being of soul and spirit, seek entry to the physical world through the mother's body following fertilization. In this way, a human soul transforms into a physical being, which is only the outward form of a spiritual entelechy. Child first has undifferentiated features, and as he develops, his human form comes ever more strongly to expression. We are wrong to believe that there is something inside the child that is emerging from within him alone. We should instead turn our gaze away from the immediate figure of the child before us, back to what was active before birth, before conception, and is now continuing to work as after effect of this, expressing itself as effect. As we observe the child from day to day, week to week and year to year, we see working into him a previous state that he passed through in soul and spirit before his birth or conception. The only justified way of regarding a child is to see that he develops certain attributes whose source does not lie within his physical organism, whence they apparently emanate, but in a past whose light still shines into him. It is the great misfortune of modern worldviews that they reject such ideas. It is important to seek time's aid, to picture an active past still working on within a child's present form. Then, if we trace the course of life further in time, plate 8, we transform corporeal nature in turn, gradually metamorphosing the physical body into soul and spirit again. In becoming physical human beings, our spirit and soul transformed itself into our corporeal nature. And then in turn we transform this back into spirit and soul. You may well see a difficulty here. You may well say that you would understand how the body transforms itself into spirit and soul if this occurred gradually, so that, say, a person had become entirely physical by the age of 35, after which he started gradually to become spiritual again, becoming so spiritual by the end of his life that death would be only a gentle transition into the realm of spirit and soul. This is what happens actually, though not inwardly, not outwardly. This is what happens actually, though only inwardly, not outwardly. Appearance is deceptive here. In declining phases of our life, I trust that the older ones among you will not take too much offense at this truth, we do start to drag our body along, like something that no longer fully belongs to us. Gradually we turn into corpses, and death, when it comes, consists only of our corpse growing too heavy for us, its weight becoming too much when our soul returns to our body in the morning on awakening. Outer appearance does not reveal the changes that are actually occurring in us, nor how in the second half of our lives we are already gradually dying. Instead of assuming a duality of mind and psyche on the one hand, and the body on the other, we should learn to understand how the spirit and soul transform into the body, and the latter in turn transforms back into the former. To do this, we need to invoke time. While this, in a sense, only outwardly expresses the course of human development, it is connected with two important human qualities. What enables us to metamorphose gradually out of a realm of spirit and soul into a corporeal realm, so that we become one with the body? We grasp what is at work here by understanding the nature of love as a moral quality. The following is a truth of principal importance. We enter the physical world through love, by pouring ourselves out into physical corporeal nature. And how do we depart again? We withdraw ourselves again from physical corporeal metamorphosis. We transform ourselves back again, and no other power than freedom enables us to do so. The fact that we can evolve further, passing through death, occurs precisely because of freedom. We are born through cosmic love, and we pass through the gate of death into the world of spirit and soul through the power of freedom we bear within us. where we develop love in the world, this love is basically the echo, the reverberation of the soul's spiritual being we were before birth, or let us say before conception. And where we develop freedom in our existence between birth and death, we prefigure, as if prophetically, our most important soul spiritual power after we have left the body behind at death. In terms of the cosmos, what does it mean, really, to be free? To be a free being, to be able to translate oneself back from corporeal into spirit-soul nature, means, really, to be able to die. Love, on the other hand, means translating oneself from the realm of soul and spirit into the physical corporeal realm. In terms of the cosmos, being able to love means being able to live. And so you see how processes that doubtless can be regarded as purely natural ones, being born and discarding the body, birth and death, which modern scientists regard as merely natural processes, can also be grasped as manifestations of love and freedom. What then are we really doing in soul spiritual terms when we develop love in ourselves out of our will? We are forming a spirit-soul after-image within us, inside our skin, of what composed our whole being before we were conceived. Prior to conception, we live in the cosmos through the power of love, and during our life on earth, between birth and death, the love we unfold as a moral virtue is in a sense a feeling, will, memory of this life we led in the cosmos. The goodness of love is like a microcosmic refinement of what is spread through the macrocosm before our birth. And awareness of our freedom becomes apparent to us by virtue of the fact that we bear in our soul and spirit during life between birth and death something that will be active throughout the cosmos, like a force of nature, once we have passed through the gate of death. These two qualities are nothing other than the resonance or echo of cosmic powers, for cosmic love is connected with every birth, and cosmic freedom with every death. The triumphant ascendancy of the natural sciences has led us to speak of all kinds of natural forces, such as light, heat, electricity, and so forth. Yet we do not speak of the natural forces, or rather the world powers, which lead us as human beings into existence in the physical sensory world, and then lead us out of it again. In fact, the physical, chemical, and biological sciences, with all they describe as the forces constituting the world, allow us to understand everything in the world that is not human. Never in a million years can we understand the human being himself in these terms. This is because we exist not only through the action of electricity, light, heat, and so forth in the world, but by virtue of love and freedom. If we really ponder this way of seeing things, really start to understand the human being, we can begin to formulate ideas about the beings of nature that are simultaneously moral and natural. Then a moral world order no longer hangs where devoid of all connection with, Then a moral world order no longer hangs there devoid of all connection with nature, nor does the natural order remain detached from morality. In the course of humanity's evolution, something occurred that has a deep inner lawfulness, but which, as we continue to evolve on earth, must in a sense be overcome if humanity is not to fall into decline. Humanity's evolution on earth started from the kind of spiritual culture that developed in the Orient and blossomed there. As we know, in very ancient times, in the post-Atlantean era, this culture reached a level still higher than later came to expression in the Vedas or Vedanta philosophy. Yet this was an outlook focused largely on a moral and spiritual world order alone. This moral and spiritual world order was great and magnificent at certain long-gone eras of humanity's evolution. But in the Orient it gradually fell into decadence and was unable to reconcile itself with a natural world order. In modern times in the West, a view of the world as natural world, as natural order has arisen, an outlook that sees the world only in terms of the forces that can be observed in the external world by means of our senses, and this is unable to arrive at a moral world order. This huge contrast between the East and the West is one we have previously discussed from diverse angles. In the East, human beings were predisposed to grasp only the nature of soul and spirit, whereas in the West, they tended to grasp only corporeal nature, and these perspectives colored all other views and outlooks. People do not usually realize how radically divergent are the concepts human beings have in different places of the globe. What a true Westerner regards as human nature is something alien to the Easterner. And when an Eastern person speaks of the human being, he is really talking of something that does not actually exist on earth. The Easterner directs his attention, his whole soul, to what the earth really has no part in and does not touch. If we went back to the dawn of the Oriental worldview, we would find that it takes no account at all of physical sensory existence, disregarding it in relation to all births and everything that governs human evolution. The human being then was an entirely soul-spiritual being and developed no proper sense of physical existence. This has an important influence on everything the Oriental can think. Today this has grown decadent, but in ancient times what the Oriental could think in relation to the social nature of humankind came to a very clear expression. And what does a Westerner think? Let's take, as an example, one of the most outstanding social thinkers of the West, Adam Smith. Western science cannot comprehend the human being, for it grasps only what is non-human. And likewise, Western social sciences do not comprehend human nature. If you study Adam Smith's title, The Wealth of Nations, you will find he doesn't speak about human beings at all, but instead of a particular region of the globe, of what grows there and can be found there, and then he speaks also of a mechanism which he gets to do the sowing and harvesting and so forth. So, here's some land, here's a mechanism, plate 8, that has to operate freely on this portion of the earth, but only as dictated by its automatic nature. This mechanism has to do all the work on this land in the right way. These are the two elements Adam Smith talks of, naming the chief characteristics of this mechanism, quote, economic freedom, close quote, and calling the piece of land, quote, private property, close quote. And this really is the basic unit in his view of society, a piece of private property with an economic mechanism independent of the other mechanisms that operate on other pieces of private property. Thus Adam Smith's concepts relate only to the cultivated earth, private property, and an economic mechanism with economic freedom. These really are his terms. If he encounters a person, he does not regard him as a human being, but sees him as representing a piece of private property and an economic mechanism, more or less accidentally possessing a head, trunk, and limbs, along with some kind of ghostly or spectral self, though this doesn't figure in the schema, and there is no term for it in Smith's concepts. So this mechanism lands here on the piece of private property, and as it starts to operate, to work, it assumes the outward form of a phantom endowed with head, trunk, and limbs. Nowhere in Adam Smith's works do you find a concept of the human being as such. Try it for yourself. You just find a convergence of private property with an economic mechanism, but nowhere any concept of the human being. In a sense, you find what surrounds human beings, but not the human being himself. The characteristic thing is that a last vestige of freedom is present here and is ascribed to the mechanism, Nothing is said about human freedom, nor of what arises from moral imagination, is filled with the spiritual content and makes us fully human. For then one would have to resort to ideas such as those in my book titled The Philosophy of Freedom. Instead, we hear of the connection between private property and an economic mechanism. On the one hand, therefore, we have the vestiges of Oriental wisdom in an incapacity to emerge from human soul spiritual nature and enter the physical world. And in Westerners, we have the ability to see something real in the world, a possession in the world with a mechanism at work on it. Here, the landowner has great estates. His lordship has external forces whereby these estates are managed and hunted. So we can see that his lordship certainly owns something. But what walks around on these estates like a mere phantom of the human being is something not truly perceived. So you can see what is needed. The human being is such in his intrinsic nature. We have to develop within us a living vision of the human being himself. Our Western science has its series of evolving animals, starting with the simplest organisms and developing into the most complex on four legs, after which they eventually stand up on two legs to become vertically instead of horizontally aligned, and hey presto, we have the highest animal called man. That's all. An evolutionary sequence of animals with man at the top. In other words, science has nothing to say about the human being, nor do the social sciences either. For here we just have our private property and the economic mechanism operating on it. Again, the human being himself fades out of the picture. The odd thing about modern humanity is that it does not notice there is nothing human here, nothing human at all. And this gives rise to a certain need. After all, human beings live in a social context. Let us assume that they live as Adam Smith sees them. For the fact he expressed this view means simply that he said what numerous others were thinking. Imagine that Westerners take a look at their social existence. They will not find themselves there at all. How is it possible to find in this concept of the human being what lies beyond both birth and death? To do so at all requires them to take it on authority. And as such ideas continued to flourish, all spiritual matters had to be taken on authority, so that people in turn began to feel reluctant even to think about the spirit. This developed further in modern proletarian thought, except that here these things were taken to their true conclusion. Proletarian thinkers said, quote, well, the bourgeoisie have reflected on the nature of the human being, but nothing of the human being exists here. There's just private property and the economic mechanism. So let's not talk about this airy-fairy idea of human nature as special. Let us just speak instead of economic forces which produce everything. Close quote. We should take this view seriously. The others do not take it seriously, for while they speak all week long as if only private property and the mechanism of economic freedom existed, on Sunday they attend sermons about their immortal soul. We really should try to be alert to this, for without the courage to look such things in the eye, we will not progress. And it is understandable that today many powers exist with a very keen interest in preventing a proper light being shown on these realities. It is uncomfortable, of course, for people to hear that while social science seeks to understand how human beings can live harmoniously together, it actually has nothing to say about human nature, speaking only of private property and of the economic freedom of an economic mechanism. I have tried to describe an approach founded on a real living sense of metamorphosis, as compared with one that wishes to know nothing about this. Tomorrow we will examine the deeper reasons largely preventing people from grasping the necessary macrocosmic consequences of these insights. Tomorrow, therefore, we will elaborate what I might call the macrocosmic counter-image of the realities described today, and will then continue by studying the human consequences resulting from each of these worldviews. The end of Lecture 7.